Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Welcome back to the show. The actor and comedian Aladdin Yula was preparing to audition for a role as a, quote, Muslim terrorist in a Hollywood movie when he began to think. Thought about his family, and particularly about his immigrant father, who left colonial India and arrived in New York in the early 1940s, working for a number of years in Manhattan as a restaurant dishwasher. Yula went on to turn the experience into the basis for his one-man show called Dishwasher Dreams. It has opened in New York for a run at the Castillo Theater. It opened in October, but you can still see it. It's up until this Sunday, November 18th, and it is my pleasure to welcome Aladdin Yula to All of It. Nice to see you.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So that day when you suddenly realized, wait, I need to rethink things, my life, my career, and also rethink my father's experience. Can you describe that for us?
Yeah, I mean, I was offered a really big part, and I was subsequently booking a lot of parts where I was playing basically the accent, and all I was doing was just doing my father's accent. So I would go into auditions and just, you know, do my father's essence, you know, in the name of Allah, we will desecrate your nation. So, you know, I was in my early 20s just really enjoying myself, but then I realized we had become like sort of the new minstrel show, mm-hmm. where they were basically using South Asians and Middle Easterners to play these stereotypical parts. And unfortunately, a lot of the actors weren't speaking up. So I just felt that, you know, my conscience was getting the better of me. And then one day at the audition, I kind of snapped at the casting director. And the producer also happened to be there. And I said, you know, the line, like, you know, I know a lot of crazy Muslims in my family, but no one talks like this. And I just said out of the blue, I said, you know, do you know any Muslims? Because most of us don't want to come to America to join a Muslim, don't want to join Muslim terrorist groups. Some of us have started out as dishwashers. Are you telling stories about that? And they kind of, they were caught by surprise because I felt like we weren't being represented. No one was telling our story. So I wanted to kind of do sort of like a Hollywood shuffle approach, the great film by Robert mm-hmm. Townsend. I wanted to do sort of a solo show that kind of made fun of that, but also kind of shared.
Made a point.
Yeah, it was satirizing the way Hollywood had just kind of minimized African Americans to just being a stereotype. And I felt in the late 90s that we South Asians had been reduced to just a stereotype. And during that time, by the way, I was the first comedian to make fun of Apu. And during
Apu
that time,
is a character
on the Simpsons.
And
so
I think
Apu is very typical of like Hollywood. They took this great character from a beautiful Bengali film that represented such a humanity, and they had reduced him to a stereotype. So it's beautiful that Hari Kondabolu, who I like to think I had a little influence over him, and I'm so proud of him, that the new generation of South Asians are not willing to sell out so quickly. They're more conscious of when they're being stereotyped. Whereas before, in the 90s, you know, we didn't have that freedom. So what I wanted to do is kind of like take the audience back in time in the 90s of what I experienced, where we didn't have a lot of choices and our agents were not willing to be our champion. We were stuck in these auditions by ourselves. And it was just a few of us, like myself, Asif Manvi. They were just like maybe a handful of actors. And we were only getting these parts that were very stereotypical. So I was very outspoken. I paid a price for it. You know, they won't admit it, but I was sort of blacklisted. I know in the comedy clubs I was blacklisted. So I created my own comedy shows. I did my own thing. And I realized that I may not be famous, but I felt like my work had a better substance. So in the play, what I talk about is that when I made this decision not to continue doing that, that I inadvertently felt a connection to my dad, who I never thought I had any connection. Like, I always make the joke, I'm about as Bangladeshi as Pee Wee Herman. So I grew up, you know, in East Harlem, really into graffiti, really into hip hop. So I felt while I was here in Hollywood, you know, away from New York, feeling like a foreigner, it was this epiphany, like, wow, what must it be like to come from a country in New York in 1940, not being able to speak the language and having this dream of owning your own business? And I realized that my dad and I were actually connected. Yeah. And the obstacles that we faced were very similar. And the experiences of discrimination that I felt, you know, was similar to my experience. My parents didn't know what that was like. I realized that my father had experienced that decades ago. So it made me have a deeper appreciation. And when I started digging through his past, I found out that, you know, he was affiliated with Malcolm X, and that when the joke was, when Malcolm X and Nation of Islam wanted to eat halal food, they were eating at all the Bangladesh restaurants. And that the conversations in those restaurants were amazing, because my dad and my uncle would challenge Malcolm X and say, you know, this is not the kind of Islam to practice. And Malcolm would respond to my dad and his cronies going, and why did you guys come to America? You know, what's going on in your country? So I found this fascinating past of my dad, not realizing that the mere fact of trying to be an entrepreneur and pursuing your American dream is probably just as radical as anything in hip hop. So here I was thinking that the hip hop aesthetic was the most radical, not realizing that my father's generation were probably even more radical and defiant than hip hop.
Isn't it interesting when you think about your parents as human beings and not your parents?
Yeah, and that was part of the problem, because, you know, I you know, in the show I talk about how when I was doing graffiti, I got arrested, and I'd call my father Uncle Tom Dishwasher, and he told me the story about how he went down south and got arrested, because, I mean, it is kind of comical, because they had to explain to my father he couldn't eat there because of Jim Crow. So he and my uncles, they were just saying, well, who is Jim Crow? I want to speak to Jim Crow right now.
Who is this Jim Crow?
Yeah. So unfortunately, these Bengalis, like, someone is heartbreaking, the way my father tells the story, that they told him in the South that the freedom that you have in Harlem is not the freedom that you have down South. So maybe you need to go back north, and they call them the N-word. And my father, you know, told me, like, so, you know, you keep on drawing, putting your signature on the wall, see if that changes anything. We got arrested, and we wanted to own our own businesses, and we did it. What are you doing? So my father, in the rare times he would share his experience, it made me realize now as an adult, like, wow, you know, my parents, they had a experience that I couldn't even, you know, I couldn't even imagine. It's like me going to Sweden and trying to open up a restaurant.
We're speaking with Aladdin Yula about his one-man show, Dishwasher Dreams, which is about his father's experience of coming to New York. How did he end up in Spanish Harlem, in East Harlem?
Well, the funny thing is that, you know, Ellis Island represents this place where immigrants came, but the Bengalis jumped ship. They were working on boats. So I made the joke that, like, you know, the water in the Hudson was their Ellis Island. So they would jump ship on and come on 12th Avenue, and some of them were housed in the Lower East Side. But the Lower East Side wasn't really welcoming. They experienced a lot of racism. So since a lot of them were dishwashers and kitchen workers, they ended up being friends with a lot of African Americans who would tell them, like, why are you in the Lower East Side?
Come uptown.
Come uptown. So it didn't matter if you were crispy black like Wesley Snipes, because Bengalis can be dark skinned. When they landed in Harlem, it was like, oh, this is home. There was a certain vibe and energy, and I really feel that Harlem doesn't get enough credit for embracing immigrants who were from different nations, such as India. And so we created this, the book is called Bengali Harlem. It's about these Bengalis that then migrated. And of course, with the advent of the L train and the subway system in the 20s and 30s, it was a larger migration. But the Bengalis that came here in the 1880s, they were in the Lower East Side. They had push carts. But by the time the 20s, 30s, and 40s came, there was a larger migration of Indians that were in Harlem. And then that's where, you know, that the marriages of the Bangladeshis and the African Americans became that first generation of mixed marriages.
It's so interesting that there's a whole culture up there that a lot of people don't know about.
Yeah, it's a lost history. It really is a lost history. And me and my partner Vivek Bald, we got grants, so we went all over the country, and we would meet. It's funny you say the children, but they're actually in their 70s, and we would ask them questions about what their childhood was like. It would be real. They'd be really emotional, you know. So I had remnants of it in the 70s. So the family gatherings, I would see African Americans. I had five cousins who were brothers that looked like the Jackson Five. They were half African American, half Bangladeshi. So my memories of my childhood was African Americans, Puerto Ricans, and Bangladeshis, you know, eating chicken curry, you know, smothered chicken and rice and beans. It was really a utopia of what the world could be and should be. So I feel like those Bangladeshis got a taste of a world that, you know, we sometimes forget existed. It's a lost Harlem. And now when you see so much division, that there's evidence that there was actually a place where people were sharing love. It didn't matter what ethnicity you were. I mean, some of these brothers couldn't speak English, and they were communicating with my aunties who were African-American. So I would go to their house, and I'd see my uncle speaking Bengali, and then my auntie would be like, yeah, he asked you, are you doing good in school? So, like, you know, it was great. It was this utopia. There's this world in Harlem that I wish the world could see. So I was trying to, with this play, kind of bring back those old memories because of what Harlem used to be like and what my childhood was like, along with this pursuit of this American dream for me to make it in Hollywood. And the discrimination that I experienced was very similar to what my father and his generation of men that wanted to own their own restaurants.
Right. You were supposed to do one thing and stay in your lane?
Yeah. And my father, you know, worked with Sidney Poitier. So he had said that when Sidney Poitier first came to the restaurants, everyone made fun of him. So all the Puerto Ricans and African Americans and the Bengalis were like, this dude's never going to make it in Hollywood. So like they made fun of the fact that he was homeless. He used to sleep on the roof. And my father was saying that he was so dedicated that he made it without having to surrender to stereotypical roles. So my father used to use Sidney Poitier as this like paradigm, this mm-hmm. role model. And, you know, we would always tell our dad, like, well, that's not the way the real world works. But Sidney Poitier is just such a role model in that he was a kitchen worker who was a dishwasher and made it. And then my father would talk about him constantly and was so proud of Sidney Poitier. And then, you know, I went back and I didn't even know this. My father used to tell us the story. It was
about
like,
this guy.
Yeah. So when I went back and I was like, oh, wow, that is a true story. But he used to tell us that back in the day, that they were men from the West Indies, because Belafonte and Sidney Poitier, they worked in kitchens. So my uncles, they knew them when they were kitchen workers.
That's amazing. We're talking to Aladdin Yulay about his play Dishwasher Dreams, about his dad's coming to America and all these sort of epiphanies you had about your dad as you looked at him as a human being, not just dad. What was it like for your parents, though? Because they clearly had on their hands a young New York boy.
Well,
growing up in New York with New York wants, desires, needs, sneakers.
Yeah. You know, a lot of younger audiences really relate to it. I mean, there's a segment where, I mean, I was so deep into hip hop. And I don't know if you remember, Run DMC had that song, My Adidas. Mm-hmm. So, like, I really wanted those shell top Adidas. And my mom was like, no, she's telling me in Bangladesh we want nothing on our feet. So I would say, Ma, I want these Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's. And she was like, did you say Kareem Abdul-Jabbar? Is he a Muslim? And I would tell her, yeah, they're $19.99. So I don't have $19.99. I would tell my mom, but Ma, these are Muslim sneakers. So, you know,
you were wrong, by the way. That's wrong.
So I would find any defiant way. So I wasn't, you know, I really didn't have a connection to that mm-hmm. Bengali Muslim. My mom tried. I was very defiant and very rebellious. But the irony is that when I went to Hollywood and here in New York, I was playing the fresh off the boat character. So the person that I was least connected to is who I ended up playing. And in doing so, it was almost like an acting sense memory type of thing. I became more connected to my father. And in doing so, in these auditions, I felt more uncomfortable and more uncomfortable until that one audition where I snapped and said, this is not cool. Why are we only playing terrorists? And it just seemed like the characters were very one-dimensional. And I just had a problem with the predominantly white casting directors who would tell me, well, do it more with an accent. And I would hear them do the accent. And it really did remind me of Robert Townsend's Hollywood Shuffle, when they would ask the black character, be more street, be more ghetto. And you'd scratch your head going, well, why am I doing this? Mm-hmm. So I realized after a while, I need to come back to New York and tell my own story and write my own plays and sort of satirize this crazy world, which I label the new minstrel show in Hollywood.
Yeah, I was watching a piece of it and someone said, do a Muslim accent.
Oh, yeah.
What's a Muslim accent?
Yeah, oh my God, there's so many experiences like that. And, you know, and when I would say, well, you know, that's incorrect, because I'll tell you, Law and Order was probably the worst. I mean, I don't care because that show is off the air. But they had me read one time for a Bangladeshi character with the last name Singh, which is a Hindu name. And I would say, well, you know, most Bangladeshis don't wear a turban. They don't have Hindu names. And they were like, yeah, speak it the way your people speak it. I was like, yo, my man, do you know what you just said is so racist? Come on, just say the part. We know you do it really well. And so they would recruit me from watching other shows that I was on. And after a while, I just felt like I don't want to be that go-to person that, you know, is just going to do the accent. So I think one of the last things I did was Real Sports with Brian Gumbel. I did, it's interesting, they did the follow-up to that segment where I did the voices of these young camel jockeys who were Bangladeshi that were getting exploited. And they were getting raped and molested. And now, I think, like 17 years later, because of that segment, the Saudi government has banned underage Bangladeshi boys. And it's all robots. So I feel like the last thing I did was ended up being like a really good thing.
Had some use. It was useful.
Yeah. So I just felt, you know, if I'm going to go broke, at least I'll go broke doing what I feel is the right thing. Mm-hmm. And I just didn't want to sell out and do that Muslim terrorist thing anymore. So, you know, yeah, it may be difficult for me to get a MetroCard nowadays, but I can sleep at night.
Well, the name of the show is Dishwasher Dreams. What were your dad's dreams when he came to the United States?
I think my father really did want to have he wanted to kind of be the forefront of Indian food. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I found out about my father's restaurant, it's kind of funny because I think Billy Crystal and a few other people's fathers, their shops was there. Billy Crystal's dad worked in the same block as my dad did. So it was on 46th and 8th. But the problem was that my father had a walk-up. So you had to walk upstairs. And, you know, people didn't really know what Indian food was. It was, I think, the late 40s. And he was, like, in his mid or late 20s. And he and two other people, my uncle, they had the restaurant. But they didn't really know what they were doing. So it stayed, I think, till the early 50s, but they didn't know anything what they were doing. But for my dad, he really wanted to be a chef. Hmm. He was a foodie. My love affair for food comes from my dad. And I think he just wanted to be a chef and have his own business.
I understand that you're working on a documentary about Bengali Harlem. Is that true?
Yeah, it's almost done. You can actually see some of the clips on BENGALI, BengaliHarlem.com. It's based on the book In Search of Bengali Harlem by Vivek Bald. I always make the joke that I'm too lazy to write a book. So Vivek, he actually got his dissertation on the research that we did on the first wave of Bangladeshis that landed in Harlem. So I always make the joke, even though I love to read, more people watch films than read. Mm-hmm. So we've shot all the footage, and we're probably going to spend the next 3 to 4 months just editing. So hopefully by next summer, early fall, we'll be able to do the festivals. And it's basically about the first wave of Bangladeshis that left and landed in Harlem. And it's more of a moving documentary of what these men had to endure. And I can't wait for it to be done, because that's the film that I think will really kind of document what they went through. Mm-hmm. So it's not a dramatization like a play or a film. It's just basically a documentary that talks about what their experiences were like.
It's important to preserve that history and to introduce people to that history so people understand this really is a lot of people's country.
Yeah, there's a lot of these stories that just are not being told. And I also, for me, I have a sense of urgency to finish it, because I feel that we have a president, we have a government, we have, I think, unfortunately, people drinking the Kool-Aid that immigrants are the enemies. And it's unfortunate, because this country was based on immigrants. You know, I always make the joke, the only true Native Americans are the ones that are on reservations. Mm-hmm. And they're the only ones that get the right to be called American. Everyone else is an immigrant. So when I hear this talk about how immigrants are so demonized, it's unfortunate, because that's the ones who came to America. I mean, that's the ones who built America. So so many of these stories have just been swept under the carpet and not being told. And unfortunately, when I see a cab driver that doesn't pick up an African American and they are Bengali or South Asian, I realize that mentality is a manufactured racism. Mm-hmm. That's learned behavior. And, you know, I've had plenty of conversations with Bengalis where I'll say in Bengali, Baya, do you know that there was a time when Bangladeshis were marrying blacks? They're like, no, no. And I realized that, you know, he doesn't know this because there's no evidence of it. So for me, I felt creating the film Bengali Harlem is not just for white people, but it's also for Bangladeshis who arrive in this country and inherit and adapt this type of racism that I feel is manufactured. And it's not coincidental that they end up that way.
Aladdin Yula's show, Dishwasher Dreams, is running at the Castillo Theater on 42nd Street through this Sunday, November 18th. Aladdin, it was great talking to you. Thanks for coming by All of It.
Thanks for having us. Thank you.
Coming up next on All of It, a conversation about wokeness with comedian Nori Davis. Stay with us. We'll be back after a quick break. You're listening to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. New York's own Nori Davis is a writer and comic who sees the funny and the humor in things a lot of his peers don't. He riffs on a wide range of topics, from hospital bills to the MTA to toxic masculinity. And his new album is no exception. Titled Too Woke, Nori Davis's new album explores questions of race, white supremacy, and gender norms. So what does too woke mean? Well, here's Nori explaining it during an appearance on Conan O'Brien's show. No clip. too wokeness. Can I do my version of it, Nori?
Yes.
What you said?
Yeah.
You said too woke is when some people see the glass half full and half empty, and you say you see it, and you say
Flint still doesn't have clean water, baby. Wake up. But first, before we get started, I just wanted to give you this. This is my promotional tape. Right there, promotional CD, two disc CD, and inside are the two woke coasters I had at my art exhibit show. That's for you.
These are awesome, the two woke coasters.
Yeah, that's for you. Everybody in the studio.
You're so kind. You brought gifts.
Exactly. That's for you.
You're kind of my kind of guest.
Yes.
Hi. How are you, by the way?
I'm good. Yeah, last Friday I had an album release party / art exhibit. And what I wanted to do was get a bunch of artists together and they do their own rendition of my album cover. But the final album cover was by Frank Williams Jr. And he's a great artist out in on the West Coast. And I had the characters and a lot of artists contribute to it. So I just wanted to give you something exclusive for my fans who received coasters and they received a hard two-disc album.
This is fun.
So the album's going to be digitally, though, for everybody else on Spotify, Tidal, and it's on Apple Music right now. You can order. You can pre-link it. There's a pre-link.
Why is it called Too Woke?
It's called Too Woke because you don't want to be too conscious. I mean, everything that's going on, all the controversy, the social issues, and who the president is, it's like, you know what? Let's not forget to have a good time. Let's not forget to turn up. Let's not forget to what makes us laugh, what makes us happy in these controversial times that we're in right now. So this comedy is taking subjects that make us sad, that make us depressed, like toxic masculinity, like white supremacy, and I turn it on their head and find the funny in it and give you a relief from it, giving people a break from the reality. The reality of racism, the reality of what diet to eat, the reality of toxic masculinity again. So it's like, let's just have fun. Let's just have fun. And that's what I'm doing with it.
So why do you think the word woke has become ubiquitous?
Because it's been overused and taken out of context where now white people use it. So once they start using it, then it's like, all right, it's over. It's not exclusive now. Now everybody's eyes are wide open. It gets saturated. It got saturated. But now I use it in a way where it's a funny saturation of like, don't be too woke. Just calm down. Not everything doesn't have to be so serious. Like where you can still celebrate Halloween, even though we know about the blackface and stuff like that. It was like, don't be so conscious on it. It's like, nah, man, Halloween's only for white people because they ain't scared of nothing. So they need that. So I'm not going to dress up. You can dress up.
It's all right.
Fine. It's all right. Have fun. Go out there with your friends. Go with your niece and nephew. Get some candy. And that's what it's for. So it's not forgetting those societal values that, you know, so that's still fun.
Yeah.
And that's what my comedy album is about. It's just like having fun on all these hard issues that drive us crazy.
Can you remember a time when you heard somebody use the word woke and you thought, no. I'm sorry, no.
Yeah. Like anybody in my family are like, matter of fact, no, not really too many people around me use it. Yeah, like now it's just the only reason I say too woke. I just say too woke. But using the word woke, it's washed out now.
Yeah.
So like only for the title. So it's good. We're getting past it. We're getting past that. Now we're getting past it. Yes.
So what in your mind made you think that toxic masculinity is a good topic for comedy?
Oh yeah, cause a lot of my girlfriends, not girls that I date, but like friends that are girls, you know what I'm saying? Cause as a man, you can have that. they've been dealing with a lot of it, you know, going through the subway system or just in sexual harassment around the city or even in their life or even their family. And it's been given a lot of turmoil, people even on Twitter and on social media. So it was just something where I just wanted to give a message to men to how to calm down, because we don't communicate with each other. We were never taught, even for me, my dad never really talked to me about it. I had to learn from hip-hop. I had to learn from TV and DMX and R. Kelly and Not Great Fathers.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to learn that myself and have a conversation with my boys and even with women, knowing what's not right, what's not how to treat women and how to talk to them. So I was like, how can I use that on my platform to give that message but also make people laugh? So I just flipped it on his head, just saying some true messages what we go through with toxic masculinity is through hip hop, we try and meet girls at a hip hop concert or a R&B concert. It's like, I don't even like Usher. I don't even know why we here.
Yeah,
why are we here? Why are we doing this? It's like, let's just let it naturally happen, the conversation of trying to meet women, shouldn't just like go out there and like hunt them.
You know, be predators, saying? Right?
Be predators. No, no need to be a predator, man. Just be a squirrel. Just chill out. they don't chill out at all. They run all over the place.
Just be nice.
Just be a koala. Just be nice. Just be a
koala?
A good person. Yeah, be a koala.
All right.
Word.
You joke about, I've got a clip this time.
All right.
You joke about the importance of crying for men.
Yeah.
Let's listen.
Like, fellas, you have to cry. If you don't, you gonna kill somebody. Just cry. It's okay. I'm not saying you have to go in the mirror and just think about old thoughts. Like, just have a trigger. Have a trigger, like a movie, anything Pixar makes. Like, my trigger is like, I go on YouTube and I just watch Kendall Jenner give a Pepsi Coke to a police officer. That makes me cry. Like, oh my God.
Okay, that.
She solved her racism.
That's a double whammy, though.
Yeah.
That's a double whammy. You, the pendulum swung one way for crying, mm-hmm. and then a backhand Kendall
yeah,
Jenner solving to. Racism through a clip based on a very significant moment during Black Lives Matter.
Yeah, exactly. I can't forget that now. I mean, like, I'm a comedian, but I'm so black. But you can also see that, and you could probably hear that. But just to let you know, yeah, that hit home. That commercial, that was funny. That's just funny. That's just ridiculous. Something so ridiculous, it has to become a punchline
yeah.
in my show, of course.
Do you think that because you're a guy, that you're able to communicate these messages to other men that maybe a female comic might not?
I feel like a female comic, well, I definitely have the same opportunity. For me, is like, yeah, I feel like each party, we need to like go within our own camps within mm-hmm. and break down the boy club and be like, yo, fellas, this ain't cool. And not like, I'm the one to do that. Just like with racism, like you want white people to talk to white people, mm-hmm. you know what I'm saying? Like to help them like really see other person's issues and live within their feet and live within their shoes, not their feet. That's weird. That's cannibalism. Sorry about that. So yeah,
sci-fi.
Exactly. So yeah, I wanted to, yeah, I definitely want to tackle that and just have and then have fun with it and give like a little bit of awareness if it wake guys up. If it do, it does. If it doesn't, we'll just keep pounding the pavement till they do, man. But I feel like there's a lot of allies now of like men mm-hmm. are really overturning, like really see like, all right, man, I can definitely change my views on this and just be a good person instead of just like keeping the gender first, you know,
yeah.
as a club. It's not like I'm a man, but that's not a gang. That's just my gender. Mm-hmm. It's not a gang. You know what I'm saying? That's all.
Talking to Nori Davis about his new album, Too Woke, coming out on November 23rd on Blonde Machine. So in August, you were part of a show at Union Hall called Yourself, Your Body. And the stated mission of this event was to dismantle social binaries and the beauty standards of mainstream media through sharing stories and reclaiming space.
Mm.
Are these things you've been thinking about for a long time? Are these things that are important to you in your personal life?
What?
Breaking down.
Yeah.
Yeah, how? Why?
Oh, of course. Yeah, it is. I'm sorry, I went to another place of like, wow, this is a great space. I'm sorry. I really love your space. It's like so dope.
It's all good.
I'm happy to be here. Yes, these things I think about, yeah, I think about so many different issues, but also what's the funny about it? What's the different perspective I could bring to stage mm-hmm. that can make people think and definitely give them a surprise? I don't want to talk about the same topics of like heterosexual sex and are like black and white problems, like just trying to progress stand-up in a way mm-hmm. to bring it back into the forefront, because like stand-up is kind of losing, well, not losing, it's not a competition, but like to podcasts and radio is just so good because it's a conversation, but stand-up is only one person telling jokes, but it's the same subjects, it's the same topics or issues. So it's like, how can we progress it? How can we move forward? Because like the audience is growing, the youth is getting smarter. So it's like, let's talk about some issues that have never been talked about from a different perspective. Hence, mm-hmm. like our food diet, toxic masculinity, white supremacy, Metro North versus the subway, you know, hip hop, you know, mumble rap, different, mm-hmm. just different and keep and forward thinking and just keeping it current and not just like the same typical jokes. Because if you think of a comedian, you'll be like, oh, self-deprecation, blah blah blah. It's like, let's progress it, mm-hmm. let's move forward.
You have a brother who's trans, right?
Yes.
So how is that, what impact has that had on your comedy and the kind of things you want to talk about?
It had a big impact because he's been going through a lot of pain, the turmoil of like transitioning and also being accepted in society and also loving himself. And thing as me being his big brother, I just always wanted to make him laugh through that. I just wanted to make him laugh. So when I would see and hear the comedians talk about the LGBTI community, it would come off in a way as they would be the butt of the joke. And I ain't like my brother being the butt of the joke, because what he's going through, they never experienced that. And they shouldn't. Mm-hmm. They don't have the right to talk about that. So it's like, I know what I experienced with him. So now I have the opportunity to find the funny, to make him laugh, LGBTI community laugh, and everybody in the world laugh too. It's possible. So I have a joke now where I talk about how he's happy with his body, and he's so happy with his body, he loves to brag. He's like, yo, I got more facial hair than you. I got more armpit hair than you. I didn't know he transitioned to it. You know what I'm saying? like it's that. And like it just, he loves that joke. Everybody just laughs at it. And it's just, I want to find that medium ground where we can all laugh and nobody is at the butt of the joke and feel shame about what they've been through.
We're speaking with Norrie Davis. The name of his new release is Too Woke. It's coming out on November 23rd. You're also a dad.
Yeah.
What flavor, boy or girl?
Girl. Girl, yeah. My little daughter, Layla. She's great. And she is in kinder. No, she's in first grade. She's in the first grade. See, I almost did the father thing right there. We always forget our kids' age. Like, oh, how old is this baby I got? I forgot about it.
No. Well, you know what happens sometimes when there's something in the news about sexual harassment or something like that. Politicians come on and say, well, as a father or my wife and my daughter.
Really?
And sometimes it seems a bit insincere, if I may be honest.
Mm-hmm.
But I do mean this question sincerely. Has being the father of a daughter made you more woke, I guess?
No, because I really feel like I always had my mom and my aunts and my sister, but then my brother now to really mold me into the man I am now, to be a good person towards women and men. So having a daughter just made me just melt more. It just made me just want to take her more to the stores and get her cute little clothes. Women just have better clothes. Boys, we don't have that many clothes. We put just H&M and Zara. Like, women, you can take them any store. They're just so cute. So I love dressing. I love doing her hair. You know, I learned that, you know, because her mother's white. We're friends. We're not together. But, you know, I got to make sure her hair tight, because I just can't have old black women looking at her hair going, who did this? Who did her
Because they do that.
And they will do that. So I was like, no, I moisturize it. So when I do my daughter's hair, she look like every album cover Mary J. Blige. You know what I'm saying? So I make sure she look good, her hair tight and nice and moisturized.
Now, before I let you go, I know you talked about this a little bit at the top, the artwork for, did you go to Pratt? Am I right?
Yeah, I went to Pratt Institute in Brooklyn.
And in terms of thinking about the art for the cover of this release, why was it important to you to have a visual representation?
It was important to me because, like, coming from a art background, like, when I went to Pratt, like, I went for graphic design, and those other kids were great. I sucked, but I always had an eye for it. So it was always good to, like, go out there and sketch out your vision, but have somebody who can execute it. And I have no problem with, like, paying for that. And there are artists out there, like, it's just so talented, and I just want to showcase their artwork on my platform with my stand-up comedy album. Because even with stand-up comedy albums, we have the capability of, like, coming up with anything. Like, the possibilities are endless. So it was just like, I got inspired by having seven characters, kind of like what happened to Monday, or like, and I just wanted to do like a black version of that with me. And I just came up with seven different characters, and I let the artist, I just gave them the characters and I gave them the title, and I said, go for it, man. You have total creative control. And what Frank William Miller, Frank Miller Williams Jr. came up with was just impossible. Like, it's just beautiful. It just blows my mind still.
It's really cool you gave people the opportunity too.
Yeah, yeah.
That's
so
nice.
Like, we had like 13 artists that submitted to the art exhibit that I did last Friday for the New York Comedy Festival. Mm-hmm. It was so dope.
Norrie Davis, it was a pleasure to meet you.
Always a pleasure to meet you.
Thank
this
you
is fire.
Norrie Davis' new album is called Too Woke. It's available for purchase and stream on November 23rd. And it's very funny. Thanks, Norrie.
Thank you. Gang, gang. Hit me on Instagram, Norrie Davis.
When we come back, we'll look at art with the prolific artist, Alex Katz. Stay with us. This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Stewart, the prolific artist Alex Katz has had exhibitions in major museums all over the world, including 200 solo exhibitions and 500 group exhibitions since 1951. Yet for many years, he has been seen as outside the mainstream art community because of his approach to painting and painting what he sees, what's right in front of him. Now his work is set to be displayed in the New York City subway system and Seoul, Korea, plenty of other places. He's got shows in Europe planned for 2019. In his ninth decade, he's not slowing down. He's just published a book, Looking at Art with Alex Katz, where he walks readers through 90 key artists and how he encounters their work. I'm so pleased to welcome you to the studio. Hi, Alex. How are you?
Oh, pretty good. Thank you.
So when you say looking at art, when you look at art, what does looking at art mean to you?
Well, you stand in front of a painting and you look at it. It's really kind of simple.
When you're looking, what are you looking for? What are you looking at?
I never think of it that way. It's sort of, you look at it and each thing, it has to do with your interest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you look at a painting and it has to do with the artist's interest. And you look at the painting and you think about the artist and think about what he's doing. And you have your reactions to it. And I think different people see paintings different ways, you know?
Yeah.
An uneducated person will just see a picture, you know? And the connoisseur will see something else. And I'm a painter, so I think I see things maybe perhaps a little differently than an art historian or a museum curator. Or a person who hasn't got too much knowledge of the craft.
What is it about certain paintings that appeals to you? Are you someone who is drawn to color? Are you drawn to texture, composition?
It has to do with energy.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, some paintings have a lot of energy and some paintings don't, for me.
Yeah, some are sometimes flat.
Well, you don't get anything from a painting. Your visual perception is very quick. It's usually quicker than you can think. You have a reaction to a painting, and I can be in an elevator. They open the door. There's a show, and I just close the elevator. I saw the show.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not interested, and I can spend minutes in front of some paintings trying to figure out how this artist did it.
Interesting. So in this book, you have 90 artists. How did you decide which artists to include?
Well, the process is about 20 years, 25 years. We started in Frankfurt, and they were doing a catalog, and I put a couple of editions in. I thought it'd be interesting for people to see how I thought about other artists. And then it was redone, and we put more in, and then they made a big book of mine, and they decided to include a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
And then the editor there decided it would make a book. And then at King, I don't know the woman's name, but so they asked me to do some more. So we put some more and we made a book.
Yeah. It's interesting that you said the word energy, because I turned to the page about of Jackson Pollock, and you have the She-Wolf is one of the great masterpieces in MoMA. The Ab-X strip paintings freed us from Europe and enabled us to see Tintoretto and Venice and Rubens in a new way. The energy, your word, mm-hmm. of the black and white heads is amazing. The substance of the energy is in a class of its own.
Well, if you experience a great painting, it's not like a sunset in that the painting stays with you for the rest of your life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a unique experience with a painting. And there are a lot of beautiful things you see, but They sort of merge and disappear. But painting is a specific object, and you have a specific experience that goes with you your whole life. I'm talking about paintings that I hadn't seen in 60 years in their book. You know?
We're speaking with Alex Katz about his book, Looking at Art with Alex Katz. You have Da Vinci in here, David Hockney, Giacometti. Do you think people come to those kind of people who are household names? Do they come with preconceived notions? And if they do, what would you tell them to think about rather than like, that's a Hockney or that's a Da Vinci?
Well, I think the paintings are not set in stone. In other words, the fashion about paintings changes every 20, 30 years. So if a person has read a book from 30 years ago, it doesn't correlate with now. So it's another place and another time, and the painting's a little different. You relate to it differently. And so I think the writing on art, a lot of it is very good to set out your mind thinking, but it's not good in terms of it being fixed.
That's interesting. So to your point, you can visit the same museum in your 20s, your 40s, and your 60s, and you could have a completely different experience with the same painting.
Same painting, sure. Yeah, you can, the painting changes, you change, and painting's a subject to fashion, as is everything else. And El Greco was out of fashion in the 19th century, in fashion in the 20th century, then out of fashion in the middle 20th century, and now some people are interested in it again. Mm-hmm. Yeah?
It's interesting, you have the Mona Lisa in here, and I'm curious if you have feelings about paintings like that, which have become part of sort of cultural, you know, wallpaper isn't really a fair term, yeah, but that are so.
But you only know like
obvious, I guess.
Well, something like Mona Lisa, you know, it's you've seen it in reproduction so much, you know.
Yes.
It's completely different when you're seeing the painting. There is a difference with some paintings. Maybe they're better in reproductions. Actually, they're like illustrations. But with a real good painting, you can see a reproduction a million times, and when you see the painting, it's completely different. It's really physical. The Mona Lisa, I was very interested in the craft of painting, and I found that the craft in that was not painting, it was like drawing, you know? And I didn't think the impact of the image, though, was fantastic, you know. And it's mostly they talk in the books. They talk about the Mona Lisa's smile, but for me, it's like something out of art history. It's like from the Greeks, the smile. But the eyes are very alive, and then you start looking at the eyes. It's almost like he's there watching you, and if I could think that, you've got to be sure that he thought of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a more beautiful painting than I thought. Maybe because I had seen it reproduced on mugs and t-shirts, than when I actually saw the painting, it really struck me. So that's a beautiful painting.
Yeah. I like the drawing a lot in the British Museum. I went into that.
Are there one or two artists in this book that are important to you?
Well, I think, you know, a lot of them are.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
do you mind sharing?
Yeah,
a few?
Yeah. You're affected by. You're affected by your environment, and you're affected by all the things you see, and you know, you learn things from looking at art. You learn things about craft.
Mm-hmm. And who is somebody in this book that you think you've learned from in the course of your?
Oh, I learned from a lot of people. Thutmose, the Egyptian guy. Matisse, Udomaro, you know. And there were artists I just think are so fantastic, and I don't know whether I learned anything from, like Vermeer. He's very fantastic artist. I don't know what I learned from him. No, I'm just another person. And someone like Mondrian was sort of, has so much passion. You know, and passion's outside my temperament.
It's the best thing I've heard all day.
Yeah. You know, I admire his passion. I love the paintings. But I just don't have passion.
Oh, that's funny. We're talking with Alex Katz. The name of his book is Looking at Art with Alex Katz. You know, we on this show every Monday do a segment about classical music and trying to bring classical music to people who think they might not like it, and sort of telling the stories behind some of the pieces and some of the composers. You know, for some people, they think a day at the museum is like a day at the dentist. I, I can't stand going to a museum. What advice would you give to someone who's thinking, I just can't?
If you don't like go, don't. If you don't like it, don't go.
Really, you don't think art's accessible to everyone?
I think it should be, but people get kind of. I think art is a part of everybody, you know, mm-hmm. and like so is music, but they get short-circuited by the environment.
Interesting. Okay.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't experience what's inside of them by another artist of any sort, and and it breaks down to cultural identification, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You have cultures that you have like gypsy music with minor chords,
mm-hmm.
right? You have a big audience for that. And if it comes into America, it's Westerns and Russian gypsy music, the same thing, mm-hmm. and Mexican stuff. It's all on the same level. A lot of people like it, and some people don't like it. Then you get into stuff that has an audience, but that big an audience. That would be jazz, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that like has a culture
associated
and an audience in it, too. And it's a more sophisticated audience in terms of music, you know?
Yeah.
And you had the rock and roll, which is universal.
Yeah.
You know,
mm-hmm.
more universal than gypsy music or folk music.
Well, it's three chords.
Yeah,
they're those three chords everybody knows and feels comfortable.
Rock and roll. You go to Russia and you find 7-year-olds and 80-year-olds dancing the rock and roll. You know, it's one of those things like Levi's.
I was just saying, it's like blue jeans.
Blue jeans.
That's exactly what I thought.
It's American cultural American cultural thing. It doesn't make it better than anything else. It just makes it more negotiable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We're speaking with Alex Katz about his book, Looking at Art with Alex Katz. But I want to talk to Alex Katz about Alex Katz for a minute or two. Your wife, you've painted your wife more mm-hmm. than 200 times. Mm-hmm. How did you first meet her?
Huh?
How did you first meet your wife?
Oh, I met her at an opening. You know? And then a week later, we went to a party, and I asked her to dance. And I came from Queens, where they did a halftime Lindy Hop, and you could dance only from people from Queens, some parts of Manhattan and Harlem. You couldn't dance with anyone else in the world. And if I had a girlfriend, it would take me about 6 months to teach her how to do it. So I danced with Ada, and she followed. Says, oh, it went from Queens College to Brooklyn College. I didn't realize it because Brooklyn Lindy Hops were very violent. You know?
Mm-hmm.
They go up and down and sideways. And, it's not sophisticated. And she followed. And 40 years later, she told me she figured it out on the spot.
Did she really?
Yeah. She's the best social dancer I've ever met. She could dance with a kangaroo. Anything a guy does, she can do. You know? So that was it. And it was sort of like, generally with dancing, you hold a woman's hand, you touch her body on the shoulder or something, and in about 3 or 4 seconds, you know everything you want to know about the woman.
Hmm.
Right? For me.
You tell me.
Yeah, well, I know everything I want to know in a couple of seconds. And that was it.
What,
right there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What is it that you like about painting her, and you keep coming back to her?
Well, she's she went to a lot of movies when she was young, the 40s movies,
mm-hmm.
and unconsciously she picked up all the gestures. So Ada never makes a bad gesture
mm-hmm.
at all, ever. And I was doing a shoot in Paris with models, and the photographer said, looked across the room and saw Ada. Said, Ada's better than all the models. This is perfect at gestures. She's, you could make her, put her in different roles. You could make her into the American Beauty.
Yeah.
She's like Miss America. She has all the things for Miss America. She said, 3 more inches and I could have nailed it. She wasn't kidding.
And she sounds like she's a good person to spend your life with. Alex Katz, thank you so much for coming to the studio. Yeah. It's really a pleasure to meet you.
Right.
That's our show. Thanks for listening to All of It. Join us tomorrow at noon on WNYC. All of It is produced by Megan Ryan, Rosie Guerin, Catherine Millsop, Andres O'Hara, Joseph Caprileone, and Ursula Summer. Matt Miranda is our engineer. Luscious Jackson does our theme music. You can follow All of It on Instagram and Twitter at All of It WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you tomorrow.